Hi, everybody. I'm Tony Malrick, and I'm a persistently procrastinating but ever so grateful Al-Anon member. And by the mercy of God, the help of the program, you Al-Anoners and AAers, I have not found it necessary to plan a murder nor to contemplate suicide since October of 1970. The truth. May I take this moment to thank Mel and the committee and all you people for the opportunity of being with you this weekend. It's really a period of love, and I think you people are remarkable, and it's truly a privilege. And then to have Ray and Kay as our host and hostess has been just the frosting on the cake, of course. And they were there right from the start. And, of course, we put them to work early. We came a day early. And they've just been marvelous. And then to have a male Al-Anon, you know, most of us men realize that we don't need to be here. You know, we're not that sick, you know. Well, then one other thing, and this, before the program ever started, you know, Mel and her committee let it begin with me. They let their love begin with them, and they did this for a friend, Doug. Now, Doug was supposed to be your speaker, Doug G. He's a great speaker. Unfortunately, he came down, he contracted cancer, and he's up there battling it right now. And this group saw to it that they extended their love to him by sending him this card with their concerns, their prayers, and their best wishes. And I'll let you know, this is true. It was a very important point in turning his course of recovery, and I really think he is headed towards remission. And this is the committee, and these are the people you have here. Now, Doug sent a note to you, and if I may, I'll read it now. Hi. This Sunday morning, if things had gone as planned, I would be standing up here to say thank you for inviting me as your speaker. Because of sickness, things are not as originally planned here today. Instead, my good friend Tony, by our higher power's preferred choice, is reading this on my behalf. Our higher power obviously knows what he is about better than you and me. Tony knows more than most people how deeply moved and overwhelmed I am at the kindness of your convention committee and of many other group members here in Fort Walton Beach who contacted me and sent me their loving concern, although as yet we have never met. Tony is also aware that when I was fighting, step one, to admit my initial powerlessness over cancer and regain my mental stability in this lymphonic nightmare, the concern you gave me over the miles renewed my strength, built my hope, and wrapped me in love like a long-distance hug. This fabulous program works because it is all love. You care for me, though you've never met me. I'm grateful because you care that much. We, all of us, are sharing this morning because we care. We are no longer dependent. We are interdependent. We need each other. I hope that by handing over in my third step each day my will and my life to the care of God as I understand him, that someday, if it is his will for me, I can stand here and say thank you to all of you for who you are, for what you give to me in my present sickness, and for the love you have shown to me. You gave me the best remedy in the world. You cared and you shared. Doug. And just one more thing. Mel has some programs at the admissions desk, and if any of you have an opportunity or the time to stop by and just sign your name and pen any thoughts or prayers or concerns, I'd be most happy to take those back and sort of complete the hug from you. Well, before I launch into my eulogy on Al-Anon, I'd like to say a word to the AAers. Now, Marianne, you had them show their hands, and so I know there are a lot of them here. And my gosh, let me say, 7 years before I ever knew there was such a thing as Al-Anon, it was the AAers who gave me their support, who kept me saner, until I could walk through the doors of Al-Anon. And I certainly want to acknowledge this debt. I really thank you. But there's one AAer I'd like to single out, and she was my greatest teacher and my most aggravating adversary. She took me to the pits of despair and the pinnacles of joy, and she was my biggest problem and my greatest blessing. Not only did she do the damnedest things in order to gain me the right to belong to Al-Anon, but in so doing, she so brainwashed me that even I had to question the sanity of my own principles. But beyond that, she taught me how to love. Now, not just the lovable, not all of us or any of us can love the lovable, but she taught me how to love the unlovable. And certainly there is no one more unlovable than a full-blown practicing alcoholic. And with that, I'd like to introduce my wife, Helen, would you mind standing? Now, the big book says that we're supposed to tell what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. Unfortunately, the description I remember was that given by Dan Anderson, who's the director of Hazleton Treatment Center up at Center City, Minnesota, and it was on the occasion of Helen's second vacation at Hazleton. And he said this, quote, he says, "Tony is a pompous, self-righteous horse's ass." Now, he's wrong. He never completed that. I really don't want to argue the point. What I'd like to do is to try and go back and give you a little background so that you may have a little insight into why I might come to be described this way. Now, my memory takes me back to when I was a little kid in Caledonia, Minnesota, and I was sitting on the back step of our house with my arm around my dog, and I felt lonely and sad and unwanted, and I didn't know where I belonged. And I didn't have friends my own age, and I just didn't seem to know how to make friends. And this might have been because at the age of 4, I was placed in an orphanage for a couple months. At 5, I was away at temporary boarding school for a couple months. At 6 and 7, I was away at boarding school through the whole years, a nice boarding school. But it always, I seemed like I was the new guy on the block, and I always had to prove myself, be worthy of having friends. And I just had one heck of a time making friends, and this was terribly important to me. Now, I had no problem with the adults, you know, those in charge. I'd been given a set of rules by my folks, and they told me that I had to be a good boy, I had to do my best, and of course that always included anything worth doing is worth doing well, and then also that I had to obey my parents and those they put in charge of me. And so, needing friends, of course I worked at this, but when they'd given me these rules, I was an intelligent kid, you know. And so I had to check those out, and of course I did so by deciding my way of doing things, And the only thing that got me was something in the end, or else they ignored me, and I didn't like those. And then when I did do things as they liked, as they had recommended, well, you know, my mom was so darn nice to me. She'd smile at me, and she'd hug me and pat me on the head. And even my dad, when he was around, at least he wouldn't scowl at me. So I had this as a little background, and wanting to make friends and needing friends, I obeyed and I worked hard. And I did so well that by the time I was finished with the second grade, they wanted me to skip the third. And of course, the rule behind this is this: what you live with, you learn. What you learn, you practice. And what you practice, you become. And I worked hard at this. And there was another sort of principle that ruled my life from about this time, and that was that life was a veil of tears, that the good die young, and that we had to struggle each day in order to earn our reward at the end of this life. And those were the principles that I worked on. And of course, you know, as you go up the ladder of education, you know, to prove yourself, to show your accomplishments becomes more difficult as time goes. And so I had to become defensive, and I had to be perfectionist, and of course, people pleaser, I always was. And so I got those pretty well ingrained, rigid, in other words. And so, but about that time, I was married. Now, neither Helen nor I knew that she were alcoholic. I did realize she drank differently. She drank potent drinks from large containers. But so did all her friends. My gosh, they drank frequently, and they drank heavily and partied frequently. And, of course, they were from the big city of St. Paul, and I was from the little town of Caledonia. So I thought that I was the one who was out of step, you know. Well, that word frequently reminds me of arguments. And you may not know it, but things so compatible, there's a difference between engagement and marriage. Things so compatible before marriage became a complete misfit of purpose and direction just hours later. I mean the same day. And I tell you, I wondered, now, what the heck is going on? You know, there's these tears and this erratic behavior, and I was confused. And that began the longest part, period, of what I call this active disease. And as a matter of fact, I can give you my whole talk in five words. Pay attention now. Confusion, chaos, crisis, recovery, spiritual. And confusion, yes, as I said, it started right then. And, you know, this doggone disease is insidious, you know. And that word, I like that word, because it means stealthily treacherous and deceitful. And I think that well describes the way this comes on, and all of a sudden it's gotcha. And the period lasted through about 10 years, and at the end of that time, Helen's ninth psychiatrist came into her room at Miller Hospital, and he says, "Helen, you're nothing but a damn drunk, and why don't you get into AA?" And that night, I took her to her first meeting, and that was March 2nd, 1964. And, of course, this disease is progressive, you know, and so we went into chaos. That was what I call the second part. And I like that word chaos because it means unpredictable confusion and disorder. And I think that describes this disease perfectly. At least it was completely unpredictable for me, and confusion and disorder were rampant. Well, then we get into crisis, of course, and that has three features. Crisis is a short period, which is nice. And it's short because things are so critical, see. And then, of course, you have to make a decision. You can't stand it, you know. And you either make the right decision or the wrong. I guess I made the right decision. I got into Al-Anon, and I call that my recovery. And, of course, the spiritual, to learn this program, to put the spiritual aspect or this spiritual program to work, took many years. Well, that's my talk. And, well, all the rest is window dressing, so I want to warn you people, and anybody who stays here, it's at their own risk. But of course, since you're staying, I presume that you want me to prove that I have the right to be here, and also the right to be in Al-Anon. And there wasn't anything particularly unusual about what happened to me. As I've heard, everybody else has had the same things happen. And one of the things that come to mind, I've already mentioned, were psychiatrists. Well, there were a lot of them in our particular situation. As a matter of fact, as Helen said, she interviewed 11 of them during the active part of this disease. And you know, this erratic behavior just had me confused, as I said. And well, being a neophyte physician, I had to think, well, she's neurotic, you know. And I thought, well, I tried to figure out which neurosis it was, and I never could figure it out. So I had to get the help of a psychiatrist, and by the time we'd been married 9 months, she was seeing her first psychiatrist. Another thing that comes along in this particular disease, and at least for me, loneliness was the most devastating emotion that I found in this particular disease. And I mentioned to you that I felt I didn't belong, you know, even before I ever knew there was such a disease or a person with it. And but when the time came for marriage, and I was thinking about marriage, why, you know, I thought, gosh, finally I'm going to belong. Finally, we're going to have our own family. That's where I belong, and that's where the joy is going to come. And we're going to be close, and we're going to be intimate, and we're going to share everything. I'm going to tell her everything, and I did. And when I'd come home, I'd even share the mistakes I make. And you know, I don't like to talk about those. And but never could she trust me enough to give me her feelings. And so I had to wonder what's going on. And I didn't realize, of course, that she couldn't talk about her alcoholism. And so a wedge was driven between us, and there I was again, alone. And my answer to this was prayer. And of course, that was really a tremendous consolation. And I prayed, and 5 years, 10 years, 15 years went by, and of course I knew his ways, God's ways, were not my ways. And so I kept praying, but during the last few years, when things were so critical, I had to wonder, have you abandoned me also? And that gets to be a lonely, lonely place. Well, other features of this disease, finding the bottle. Now, I know that's happened to all of you. And my version is just this. One night I thought I had a heartburn or an ulcer or something like that. And I'd brought home a whole mess of samples of Jellicil, an antacid. So I went looking for them, and I found them under the sink in the bathroom. And I pulled one out and shook it up, you know, and took the cap off and took a swig and... But you know, vodka doesn't belong in a Jellicil bottle. February 10th, or 10 below in February, whatever it is, you know, reminds me of being locked out of the house. It was colder then. But I remember I came home, had supper, and I don't know whether I used it as an excuse or whether I really had to, but I made a house call afterwards, and I came back, and I never carry a key because our garage is attached to the house, and I turned the knob into the kitchen, and it was locked. Well, I went to the front door, and I turned that knob. It was locked. Well, I started using my kidneys, you know. And I... And I rushed around to all the other knobs, and they were all locked. And so I went to my daughter's room and rapped on her window, and there standing in her doorway was her mother, and she said to her, "If you let him in, I will never love you again." And that's those poor kids living between two such sick people as we. And I should say something about the affliction of the children. Every child in a chemically dependent family feels guilty. They feel that it is their fault that the alcoholic has this particular illness. I mean everyone. At least I was a sponsor in Al-Anon, and I asked every one of the kids for those 2 years when I was sponsoring, and every single one thought they were guilty. Well, I don't have the time, really, to give it justice. May I just mention this? This is from Sharon Wegscheider's book on this family disease. And she says, no one escapes from a chemically dependent family. No one. And each member adapts to the behavior of the chemically dependent person by developing behavior that causes them the least amount of personal stress. And I really think that's true, at least in our family. All our kids did this, and so did I. I took the line of least stress. Well, let's see, other things that happened. Treatment. Now, that might have happened to many of you, a spouse and so on. In our case, Helen went to Hazleton 5 times and once to Hastings State Hospital A&D unit. So we were pretty busy. And I want you to know that I was potentially a good Al-Anon member. At least I certainly, I tried to let her know what she should be doing. I, of course, realized what was right, and I informed her of such, and I managed, I tried to manage, and I sort of had to work things out many times for her. But, the second time she went to Hazleton, of course, obviously she slipped, and it was my duty to find out why she slipped, you know. So I went up there and I talked to Lynn Carroll, and he was reputed to be one of the finest counselors. And so I asked Lynn, I said, how do you know when they're going to slip? And he says, you don't. And he said, but, he said, if they miss a meeting, be careful. If they miss 2, they're thinking about it. And if they miss 3, they're probably already underway. So, by gosh, I did my duty. I went back and I kept a close eye. And sure, she missed. And so that next week, I did my duty. I brought it up every evening and at the meal, or at least. And about the value of this program and the support that the members give and how wonderful it was. And it came the night of the next meeting, and so again I was on the subject, and came time to leave, and she went to the bathroom, and I waited and I waited and I waited, and finally I rapped on the door and I said, we got to go. I said, we might even be a little late now. She said, I'm not going. I said, oh, you got to go. I don't got to go, she says. And of course she was locked in there, and I tried. I don't feel that strong that I can break those doors down. So at any rate, you can bet the next week when the time for the meeting came up, I saw to it that she didn't go to the bathroom. And, so at any rate, I said, well, it's time to go to the meeting. And she said, I'm not going. I says, oh, yes, you are. She says, oh, no, I'm not. Well, I picked her up and put her in the car, and we drove off to the meeting. And we got down to Highway 13, and I had to stop, and she opened the door and walked off into the night. Well, you know, what am I going to do in the middle of this all these cars, this traffic, you know? Well, I turned down and finally got on to 13, and our parish was right there. So I thought she probably was hiding in those buildings. So I went around. I looked through all the buildings, you know. Of course, I missed the pastor's house. I certainly didn't want to tell him of the problem we were in. And about an hour went by, and sheepers, you know, it was cold, and it was sleeting, and I was wet and cold, and it was windy, and I ducked into one of the entranceways, and just sort of wonder what the heck I'm going to do now, and I just was really befuddled, and a voice came from the darkness that said, "Well, I'm sure the meetings are over. We might as well go home." Oh, well. I tell you, I was a little displeased. And I learned something from this. I learned that if you're going to take anybody to a meeting against their will, be sure there's two of you in the car. Well, I really didn't learn anything for years, you know, the first step. But at any rate, there was another thing about going to Hazleton. Every time she'd go up there for 4 or 5 weeks, they would give me an hour with one of the counselors. Of course, I wasn't very ill, so it wasn't necessary. But they were pretty nice. They'd talk to me, and by the time she'd been there the fifth time, I'd worked up my way all the way up to the chief counselor. And Dick says to me this time, he says, "Tony, have you ever thought of Al-Anon?" I says, "Al-a-who?" And he says, "Oh, it's a program for the family and friends of the alcoholic." And I said, "Oh," I said, "well, what do you do, and what are they about?" And he said, "Oh," he says, "they're in the phone book." And he says, "Why don't you," he said, "look them up and pick one out near your place and go ahead." And do you want to? Sure.
"Please excuse me. There's an emergency call for Rick Doleboy, 244-1352. Rick Doleboy, 244-1352.
Sorry. Let's see. We were up at Hazleton, weren't we? Oh, yeah. Dick was talking to me. That's right. And so, he said, "Well, look it up in the phone book." He said, "You know, and find a place and just go." And, you know, with that very dynamic, forceful recommendation, I rushed right out of there. And about 4 or 5 months later, I found a meeting. And I remember, I can't tell you a word that was said at that meeting, but I remember one gal was doing this, and another gal was doing this, and I think one's knitting and one's tatting, and I thought these were prerequisites for belonging to Al-Anon. And I really didn't know whether I wanted to learn these. And so I didn't rush to my next meeting. But I do remember, you know, if your higher power decides that something's going to happen, watch out. And sure enough, just like that, out of the clear blue, Nick called. Now, I didn't know Nick from Adam, but he says to me, says, "My wife's alcoholic, and I understand you've got a problem." And he says, "How's about getting together for lunch, and maybe we could talk?" And I thought, "God darn, this guy might have the hot poop, you know." And so I really wanted to get together. And I said, "You know, this is my afternoon off Wednesday." And I said, "I was planning to have lunch in about half an hour. How's about coming over?" Well, he did. You know what he was up to? He wanted me to go to Al-Anon. And sure enough, they coerced me. And Ed and he, one on each arm, took me to my next meeting. And it was all men's group, the Monday night all men's group at Midway. And Sally, Alice knows about that. And so at any rate, I got there, and there was a nice group. They were about 16, 17, and there was a fellow in charge. And before he started, he turned over to me, and he says, "Tony," he said, "do you have any questions?" I said, no, let me listen." And so they went around, and they were on a step, and each one had something to say, and got back to him. And again, he looked over at me, and he said, "Tony, do you have any questions now?" And I said, "I'm sort of a quiet guy, and I don't like to rock the boat, make too many waves." And so I said, "No." And he said, "Well, is there anything you'd like to say?" I don't know, I must have got a burr under the saddle or something, and I Cal, darn it, I said, yes, as a matter of fact, there is. I said, if this is Al-Anon, there's nothing here for me. I said, I've listened to every one of you, and not a one of you knows what a problem is. I said, you ought to hear about problems. I said, I'll tell you about problems. I started, ranting and raving, as a matter of fact. And then the darndest thing happened. I looked out there, and some of them were smiling. And some of them were nodding, you know. And I thought, my gosh, what a kooky group this is. Here I'm telling them their outfit's no good, and they're sort of agreeing with me. So I had to calm down, you know, and I heard myself, and I, of course, had to stop and look for the nearest door. And then the darndest thing happened. I felt so light, you know, and I actually felt good. I hadn't felt that good in 15 years. And so I had to eat humble pie, and I told them that there must be something here because I really felt pretty good. And they were real nice. They even invited me back. The things were happening too fast and too critically now. I really didn't understand the program well enough. And such things as suicides, and we had that on a fairly frequent basis at our place. And I did all the wrong things in respect to suicide, and like Helen cut her wrist the first year we were married, and I had a heck of a time sewing her up, and then I got sort of used to this, and you can get used to suicide attempts and threats, and she'd change every so often, and I'd get all excited again, but time came when she almost completed it, and actually she was in intensive care for 4 days and nights before they finally told us that she might make it. Well, she did. She did make it, and she came home, and about 6 months later, I guess she thought I was planning to get her into treatment again at St. Mary's, and she didn't like George Mann. He was the director there, so one day when she was picking up the kids to come home, she asked them if they wanted to go on vacation with her. Well, two of them said yes, and the other one said, she'd better stay with Dad. And so she disappeared with two of the children. And this, with the threat of taking her life and the children's life, was really a terrible scare. Again, for 4 days, we were wondering what was going to happen. And finally came a call, and she had this question for me. She said, if I come home, will you promise not to put me into treatment again? What a hell of a question, huh? Well, at any rate, I didn't realize that she was calling from the airport. I thought she was calling from... I thought she probably was out west someplace. But she was at the airport, and she called her 11th full-service psychiatrist, and she said, I'm sick, and would you help me? And he says, sure, Helen. He says, put yourself into Miller and Psych 4, and I'll be down later and write orders. Well, I went down there, I wanted her to go to treatment again, and I wanted her to go to Ramsey. She wasn't in favor of that. So, of course, I had to have a court hearing. And, you know, those alcoholics, they are clever, cunning, and con artists, and she takes a back seat to no one, I'll tell you. And so I knew she'd have an ace up her sleeve, and so I got real concerned and agitated and everything else, and I had 40 people there, and my lawyer and myself, and there was Helen. Well, she had her psychiatrist there. Well, the upshot of it was that she was committed and I was exhausted. Well, at any rate, she was committed to Hastings State Hospital, to the A&D unit, and I understood that she was supposed to go for a long-term treatment, not just this usual thing that she'd been on, 4 or 5 weeks. So I went home and got back to work, one night, about a month later, I came home, and guess what? There was Helen. Yeah. And she was resentful, angry, and spiteful. And she says, you don't have to worry about my drinking. She says, My lawyer told me, said if I don't drink for 3 months, I can sue you for divorce and I can get the children and then I'll live as I darn well please. My gosh. For 17 years, I'd been trying to get this gal free of these drugs, liquid and solid. And for 17 years, I had failed. And now my final effort, and I had failed on this. I didn't know what to do. I was just numb. I ran out that door, and I ran across the fields, and I finally sat down, and I cried. And I thought of divorce, and I really didn't want that. And I thought of my friends, and I wondered if they could help me. And, you know, it had long ago been proven that they couldn't help me. And I thought that God had abandoned me, and I despaired. And I thought of suicide. And then it was just like I was in a deep, black pit. Silence. And then I knew someone was there, and it was God. And then he must have given me the insight, because I said to him, I can't do anything. I can't do anymore. There isn't, I've done everything I can. Can't you help me? I guess I finally had a little humility, you know. And just like that, whether you believe this or not, a warmth came over me, just like from cell to cell, over my whole body, from my toes to my hair. I was at peace. This terrible life of turmoil and chaos was behind me. I had a new life. I had freedom. I had serenity. I had peace. Just like that, he gave it to me. And you know, this isn't the end. Of course, this is just the beginning. Because then I started working the program. Now, what I'd really like to emphasize in just a few more minutes is part of my journey into this spiritual program. And please come along with me. When I came in, again, I was confused. But even so, you know, I saw the twinkle in your eye and you smiled. You even laughed. And of course, I couldn't understand, as somebody said the other, how you could be laughing about something so serious as this. But by gosh, you had a peace. I knew you had an inner peace, and I wanted that. By gosh, I wanted that. And also, I felt good when I was with you. And so I kept coming back, and in spite of the fact that I kept asking you, and you kept saying, work the program. And I said, well, what do you mean, work the program? And God darn you, you would never answer me. And you'd say, well, it takes time. But you never answer me. I'd say, well, what do you mean, work the program? Work the program, work the program. And they never did. But he said, read the literature. And boy, I gobbled that up. And I tell you, I read everything. And you know that One a Day book? It was absolutely fabulous. And I'd read the day, you know, and I'd read 10 days forward and 5 days back. And so I'd have about 20 things I had to work on that day. And, of course, my life was spaghetti. And after weeks, not quite months, but weeks anyway, you know, I was no place. And I had to get that peace, you know. I needed it now. And so I realized, well, I had to stop all this sixes and sevens. I had to really get onto one thing. And I couldn't understand the God darn program. And I looked over all the slogans, and I finally found one that I could understand. It was live one day at a time. And so, well, even before I even came in the program, I realized that I was cross-eyed. You know, I had one eye on yesterday and one on tomorrow. And so, I used to worry about what I hadn't accomplished yesterday, and I would fantasize about the fabulous things that were going to happen tomorrow, so I never had any time for today. And so I had realized that, and I'd been working on that. So I had the idea about this one day at a time. So I started working on it. And wow, it was hard and it was slow. My gosh, was it painfully slow. And weeks later, you know, I had about a half an hour of living in the present. But even then, You know, it was great. It was an improvement. You know. And so I went on to other things eventually, and there was one or two defects of character that showed. And so, you know, self-pity and self-centered and self-righteousness. Well, to name just a couple. But I liked self-pity, you know. That was real nice. And when I'd get down, I used to like to wallow in that warm ooze. And fortunately, it didn't strangle me before I got some insight. You know, it's amazing. It's really amazing what little things will give you insight sometime. But I want to talk about a stumbling block that turned into a stepping stone by insight, and that was prayer. And that, of course, I'm talking about the second part of the 11th step. And I've been trying to pray, and I knew that, as you heard, that I was not effective. And so I was really learning. I wanted to know how to pray. And, of course, I didn't understand that second part of the 11th step. But finally, I boom, you know, the light went on, click-click. And sure enough, it says, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. You know, praying only. That's the way to pray. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us. Christ, I had it there, see? And of course, well, you know, I'd always known, at least intellectualized, that you were supposed to pray, not my will, but thine be done, but somehow or other, that just didn't fit me very well. At least I couldn't handle that. But I put this thing, this new idea, into my own words, of course, and it came out this way. I'd start the day asking for His guidance. God, please give me Your guidance. Direct me through this day and give me the power to carry it out. And that's what I went after. And by gosh, you know, I'd ask Him for His guidance and I'd roll up my sleeves and by cripes, we were great, you know. We were a great twosome. And marvelous things would happen. I tell you, it was wonderfully better. Of course, you know, I couldn't stand that too long. Sure enough, by mid-afternoon sometimes, I'd find I was really in the muck. And I'd say, okay, Malrick, what's up now? I'd learned by this time that I should look to myself first, and sure enough, I'd forgotten to ask for His guidance, you know. But even then, I'd beg His pardon and ask for His guidance, and things would be better. And so they were. But even so, I knew there were many days when there wasn't even any sunshine. But then one weekend, I was on call for our group, and this one of my buddies said he had a young terminally ill cancer patient in there, and would I see him? And I said, sure, of course. And I wasn't ready, however, for what I saw. I came into this room, and there was this white face with these deep-set black eyes. Well, I tell you, it looked like a skull with a black wig on it. That's what he looked like. He was that ill. And then I wasn't ready for what he said. He said, Doctor, he says, you got to help me live. This guy couldn't get his head off the pillow. He was that weak. And I was supposed to help him live? My gosh, you know. And fortunately, my mouth was still hanging open and I couldn't speak. And he says, he said, oh, I'm sorry, Doc. He said, you know, I know you doctors told me I'm supposed to eat, and I know I need the energy. He said, I can get the first teaspoon down, but he said the second one, he said, it goes partway, and then I gag, and I gag, and I gag, and I vomit, and he says, but I'll try. He said, no, I'll do it. Well, I got out of that room, but I couldn't get that guy out of my mind. Here this fellow was living. He was given every last bit of his energy to live one day. One day. And me, heck, I'd pass up two or three days just to get through a better day, you know. Well, there's got to be some contradiction there, isn't there? And then this psalm, this is the day the Lord hath made. Rejoice and be glad. Well, God darn, I knew in my guts that there were too many days that were a real dread, particularly Mondays. Almost every Monday was a frustrating dread. And so how could these things be? Well, one day I heard a tape, and this was by Ernie Larson, and guess what? It was on projection. Well, you know, I had dealt with self-pity, self-centeredness, self-righteousness, all kinds of other ones. Procrastination was one of them. But never, never did I think of projection. You know, it just wasn't one of my problems, I thought. But here this guy hit me right between the ears. He says, I'd say, gosh, if only I can get past Monday. You know, it's downhill to Wednesday. And then I'll have some time to make rounds, and I can make my calls and get my charts up, and then I might even have time to jog. Or if I only get to the end of the week, you know, I'll have a couple of days off. I can repair the barn, do the fence, mow the lawn, do a few of the chores that Helen generally has listed for me, and I might even have time to put my feet up. Boy, when I finish this deck, then the whole family's going to have such a great time. They're all going to be down here. We're going to have a weenie roast, and we're going to really have fun. Or wait till I retire. Boy, then I'm going to start living. I said, what? What did you say? I said, wait until I retire. Then I'm going to start living. Well, it came to me, you know, quick. The light went on. My gosh, Ben, what the heck are you saying? You're waiting to live? You're going to wait till you're in a wheelchair before you're going to start living? But that's real. That's what I was doing. And I knew, you know, that this moment is the only moment I have any control over. Right now, I have to do the very best I can right now. And then if I do that with each moment through this day, then for that day, I will be fully living, fully alive. And I finally understood that. And really, now my Mondays, are not the terrible frustration that they were. They're an adventure. They really are an adventure now. Bad parts of the adventure as well as good. But I know that there will be really interesting situation, interesting problems, but interesting situation, marvelous people. And so my Mondays are better. Well, so this kid, you know, who I told you didn't know where he belonged, had come to find, first of all, that God loved me. Secondly, that I had worth. You know, I actually had worth. Because when the greatest force in all this universe could come to me when I'm at my greatest need, my gosh, I had to be worth something. And it wasn't my accomplishments that did that. Boy, it surely wasn't that at all. It was a gift. It's a gift. It's his gift to me. And of course, accomplishments. You know, I thought that's what I had to do to earn your friendship. I had to be worthy of your friendship. And that's so darn stupid, you know. You know, to accomplish this, to show you that I'm better than you, and then I'm supposed to expect you to be friendly to me? At every age, that'll never happen, but that's the way I had it figured out, you know. And let me assure you, if anybody else feels that they have to accomplish something in order to have worth, let me assure you, you are doomed to failure. Because each time you do something, the next time you have to do something greater. And so what happens when you earn Olympic gold medal? Or what happens when you get the Nobel Prize? There's nothing after that. You've lost. It's failure. And of course, I thought problems, you know, the problems were my undoing. And how could God do this to me? You know, here I prayed, I went to church, I didn't run out of my wife, I brought my money home, I kept a good roof over the kids' heads, and I really tried to do what I thought he wanted. And here, one problem was worse than the next. And gosh, I'd have to pick myself up and dust myself off and try harder. And finally, I was down on my knees. But you know, what better place to show some humility than from your knees? And so I finally got a little humility and said, God, I can't do this. I can't do anymore. Would you help me? And with just that little opening, just that little bit, he just exploded his love in me. And here I had a heart full of love. And you know what you want to do? You know, you want to give that away. And that's gratitude. And let me tell you what gratitude is. I mean, I looked this up in the dictionary, and the only thing it says is thankfulness. But a librarian helped me with this. And after about 25 books, we came to this. There are three features to gratitude. One is thankfulness, all right. But also, it means we really acknowledge that we've received a great gift that's completely unearned, unmerited. And thirdly, we realize that we sense the obligation to repay in kind. And those three features are there. And so now I went out to you people and I wanted to repay you. I wanted to do something for you. I wanted to be of help. And so not to endear you or make you indebted to me so that you'd say, well, it's okay. No, I wanted now, I had a new attitude to help. I really wanted to help. And now with this new attitude, guess what? I found I belonged. I belonged to Al-Anon, and I belonged to the human race. And I just want to mention one thing. Please consider what God has done for me. You know, he has taken this fellow who didn't even like himself, who knew he had no worth. This fellow who had a black cloud over his head and a veil of tears below and a struggle each and every day. This life was a negative place. I was negative. And he changed me into one who had gratitude. I mean, gratitude. You can't be negative and have gratitude. Joy. And joy is the infallible sign of God's presence. And he gave me this. And he did. He said, he gave me these promises. You will know a new freedom. You will know a new happiness. And we will come to comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. And these are the promises, aren't they? And are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled amongst us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will materialize if we are willing to work for them. And I'd like to close by giving each of you this wish. And this is by Jonathan Swift. May you live all the days of your life. I love you. Thank you for hearing me out.